What's his last name?
Owsley. O-W-S-L-E-Y.
All right.
And,
Owsley. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, they are in business to run a business and make a profit. He could be a tough negotiator. One of his negotiating strategies was to explode at judicious points during the negotiation. And we used to laugh and call him out in his rain dances.
It's just for show, though.
Well, I don't know. It's, you know, we laughed and called him out in his rain dance. And, so when we were getting ready to negotiate the contract, we evaluated the proposal that had come in. We're getting ready to negotiate the contract for the last phase of the development.
Okay.
It's without through qualification. So they came in for the negotiation. We were up on the 10th floor of 4200, had a private room up there, and 110C or something. And so in the pre-negotiation work, we said, well, here's the offer we're going to put on the table, but of course, you know, we'll have to go through Jim Howard's rain dance before we get around to talking about it, or can really get down to negotiation. He was that way he did business. But we got up there, and we got in, and we went through all the preliminaries and all the discussion, and then the government put their offer on the table. And Owsley started his rain dance. That's the most ridiculous, you know, pounded the table and so on. And lo and behold, there wasn't a big flash of lightning and a clap of thunder right in the middle of his rain dance. And all of us on the government side, we just died laughing. He couldn't figure out what was going on. And here we were just dying laughing.
Well, it's true. He didn't know, but you got it. You know.
Yeah, we got his rain dance, and he got it. But so from the development side, there were two contracts. One was a production contract because we were going to have to make these at the rate of one or two a month, depending on what time of the program you're talking about. They were going to be produced. Of course, the production was overlapping the development due to the schedule.
Right.
And the difference between the development engines and the production engines is the difference in the contract. The development contract was to do the development work and get through qualification and basically, as we would say today, certified for flight. The production was to produce the engines that were going to fly vehicles.
Okay, yes.
And they had to be, in the early days we were green running those, as we call them.
Let me ask you this. There was a last development engine and then the first production engine. It's qualified for flight. The go-ahead is given for production engines and Rocketdyne starts building production engines. What engines went on the S1CT or tested? There were a number of S1D or S1CD development T test.
D was dynamics.
D, I'm sorry, dynamics. Yeah, because that was the shake and bake, I guess. And I'm wondering which engines went on those. They wouldn't be flight engines, would they? Would they be development, you think? I know it's a tough question, but it just occurred to me to ask.
But now you got to remember that wasn't in sequence as we got, because it takes some of those forgings in that engine take a pretty good while. And so they had long lead
items. Long lead items, yes.
Before we ever qualified an engine, we built some to deliver. So those on that S1CT were very likely early production engines under the production contract.
Yes, okay, okay.
I'll
ask Sonny too, I didn't think to ask him.
I had to get some records, but I think when it was delivered to the government,
sure.
Is the important thing.
Yes.
In what the contract, what it does, and how the government and the contractor works. And we spent a lot of time on the request for proposals, RFP.
Mm-hmm.
And on the statement of work and what the specifications would be that accompany that statement of work.
Okay.
The specifications are supposed to be working. And we, and that's one of the primary roles is to be sure. There's two primary roles. One is to be sure that what we want to fulfill the mission is adequately described in the statement of work and is reflected in the contract. And then the second is to oversee the work as it's being done.
Mm-hmm.
To have insight into the work as it's being done. Insight's probably a better word. To have insight into the work that's being done to see that it is doing the right thing.
Okay.
And with the right quality.
When Rocketdyne encountered this combustion instability issue, what can you tell me about Marshall's involvement in assisting Rocketdyne in the design of the injector, changes to the injector that might was... I understand the instability was... Oh, no, POGA was a separate issue. Instability was injector related.
That's correct.
Marshall has...
See, the chamber was larger than anybody built before.
Yes.
Larger, and so that gave the chance for waves to reinforce
mm-hmm. across the face. Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, now this is not meant to be technically precise, but generally speaking, kerosene engines run rougher than hydrogen engines. The
mm-hmm.
combustion process is more mm-hmm. because you've got so much more chemistry going on in hydrogen oxygen, you only got the hydrogen oxygen combined to make water.
It's very clean burning.
But yeah. In hydrocarbons, you've got all this association, disassociation, and back mm-hmm. and forth going on in the
chemically, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. So that's the... And now when I came in there were... In, so what, you know, the solution was to put baffles to stop the waves from going back and forth across the...
Mm-hmm.
And then the baffle stopped the problem, but we took a performance hit. So we ended in, and they had to be cool too. They melted a little bit. And they would melt. And so then they were drilled and the fuel was put, some cooling fuel was put through those...
the baffle veins.
The baffle themselves.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They were... hard to remember, it's been so long, but they were pretty high, and
mm-hmm.
then you drill holes and spray through to keep them cool, and that also put a little bit of extra turbulence in. Now what happened there, and a lot of this was set up in the year before I got to the transfer to the program office, but so I kind of come in and tell you what I saw when I came in.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Everybody recognized that it was a major problem, recognized that it had not been encountered before, that it was, and it was a technologically, it was a program stopper. So the government formed a team headed by Jerry Thompson, who deceased about 2 years ago. And that team, there was some engineers here, there was some engineers at Glenn, maybe you heard the name, name won't come to me.
Okay.
And Paul Kastenholz headed the Rocketdyne wing of the team. So I'd rather call it kind of two wings of the team than two teams.
I've got his phone number.
Yeah.
I'm going to be Kastenholz. I'll be giving him a call.
From the contractor side, he can give you the very detailed. Unfortunately, Jerry is not able to do that. So in the combustion stability problem, I came in about the time that they got the testing procedures to determine how stable it was, ready to go and start doing that. That's the bombing of it.
Right, exactly. To induce instability and
right,
see how it could...
Right, to induce it, that's the word I should use. And so I came in about the time when we were able to use those, to to induce it, to use some stability test, the bombing rather, we call it. And we still encounter some with certain configurations, and it was basically some knowledge of the combustion process by some very smart people. And at least my version from where I sat was that there's some very smart people that kind of got the fundamentals of the problem defined, and then we work out the bugs with basically trial and error and testing.
I'm sure a lot of this was done at Marshall too, and it's a couple of its labs, at least one, maybe more than one lab, where they actually built either scale models or maybe a one-to-one and did flow tests of their own to try to resolve the issue.
I don't remember.
Okay.
We had an engine, I mean, we put an end-to-end engine test stand in here, and I don't recall, I remember us running it as verification. Right now in the engineering world, you know, you have a big process called verification. You do the design work and you do the testing work, and then you're supposed to do verification. On that program, the way this verification was done for the engine, for the stabilized platforms and the other stuff in the guidance and so on, when they got to where they were able to do it, the contractor delivered the engine to here. Didn't do it on the J2, but did it on the F1, and we ran the independent tests on here. Same way on the Phoenix platform, it was in the guidance.
Yes.
And, three of those engines were shipped in here, and they were run through all their paces. So we ran the engine here to confirm what they did, but the basic work was done by Rocketdyne with the technical advice of this government industry team.
Mm-hmm.
They called, they called the shots.
Okay.
But the basic testing, as I recall, now Glenn of the day was Lewis Research.
That's correct, yes.
Lewis may have done some research type work.
I believe you're right about that. I think I came across that. Not extensive, but they were involved with.
Yeah, they had one of the leading combustion people in the country, combustion dynamics people in the country up there. His name just won't come to their
head. Okay. Well, I know when they started Project FIRST, as it was called at Rocketdyne, they had their program, but NASA was pulling in the best minds they could from where they could to work on it, I understand.
Yep. It was a showstopper, and it was not one that there was a known solution to, so you know how long it's going to take to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
But
solved it was.
Yeah, solved it was, and eventually got to where you could bomb the thing pretty hard. And also got some of the cutoff instrumentation so we didn't lose the hardware. You know, it was, we were able to it would shut the engine down when it got to certain levels.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good, so you didn't lose an engine every time you had an instability that way.
I understand that was part of the actual program. It had to be safely shut down and stopped without a lot of trauma to the engine or the launch vehicle.
Yes.
Because you couldn't have these even worse oscillations. I see you've got three astronauts up there as it's shutting down.
Yeah.
Well, Pogo was the issue, but that was a separate thing.
Yeah. Here are the, I think we've got a bound version of that somewhere, but there's kind of, you may have it,
oh, okay.
You may not have it.
I can copy this and return it flat. And what's nice is it gives dates here, all the way back to 58. This
yeah,
is,
I don't know if you're interested in that or not.
Yeah.
And there was a production schedule before this, but this gives you some idea in November of 66 what the production schedule looked like. I was revised in February of 67, and then what it looked like in November of 67 and September of 68, which was when they were looking at things beyond using the Saturn V. That was production. You were talking about production.
Okay.
The one of the things between production and development, once you solve a problem in development, you have to, once you solve a problem in development, you have to then get that change into the production engine. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of the configuration management control change comes in. What configuration did you test, and what are the configurations you built, so you know which ones you got to what make what changes to. So that configuration management is very important to an orderly way of deciding whether the change is worth making or not, and an orderly way of knowing which items have to be changed where.
And on which engines they occurred.
Right. You have to remember this was in, I don't know, probably Azier dollars, but there's the kind of money that was being spent on the F-1.
Okay.
I don't know whether you've seen that or not.
$48.1 million for that 66. Okay.
And we were running, if you go to across the top up here.
Yeah, at the beginning.
$60 million was about what we were running through the development program, and then as we begin to get further out, you can see we stepped down.
Mm-hmm.
After we got past qual, and then we had to have a flight support program because you can't just throw away when you got launches.
Yes.
And you can't just throw it away. So the development funding, that contract I was talking about on the Alpha business when we had that big laugh was negotiated about long here somewhere for this rest of this stuff. And then the launches were set up like so for the lunar program.
Okay. Well, anything you do loan to me is just that loan to me. I just need them for a couple of weeks, and then I'll make what copies I need and return them to you.
There's some, I don't know, do you have any interest in any of them?
Comparative, I'm sure people will ask, why didn't you include a comparison chart? So I may put that in the appendix.
Here's the F1 and J2, I don't know. I don't know where.
J2 was quite an engine, and it looks like it's going to be quite another engine.
Yeah, hard to use it. Show you one thing on one of those cards.
I don't know which one it is here. Is it one of
these? Probably.
Okay.
Which is the point I was trying to make earlier. If it doesn't show up on here. Yeah, notice here. We had to start procuring stuff for the engine way back here. In 63.
So you mean for flight engines?
Flight engines.
Yeah.
And I think these, notice here we built, of the 1500K engines, we built 28. So the 1500K engines are probably the ones that were on the S1CT.
Okay, yes.
And the final spec was...
Because I know they had to upright the engine because they wanted to launch a bigger lunar or a heavier lunar module and the rover with that too.
Well, yeah, that was basically done. We were trying to get as much margin as possible. And here's where we produced the 15.2K engine, which was the 22K upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't much, but on five engines, it's another 100,000 pounds of thrust.
Mm-hmm.
And,
It takes care of the extra payload that needed to be.
So the change control comes in. We were not through. We didn't start qual and liability demonstrations until almost a year and a half after we started production. And so change control has to control all this stuff here. I don't know if you want this stuff. I can go run your copy in a minute.
Oh, all right, sure.
If you want it.
All right. That'd be great.
I don't want to get you off track about what you're interested in. This is the stuff that I grabbed up. There's a J2 chart. It's parallel to the J2 chart.
I wish the F1 chart was this clean. You see how clean the J2 chart is?
Yeah.
The F-1 is not like that. F-1 program milestones.
Now, here's some of the tabulations. Give you an idea of how it works. This is the F-1 engine program for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Tests and premature calls.
Well, we'll do it back to 61.
Back to 61. I mean, I think that's when they started testing.
Mm-hmm. Edwards?
March, April, May, June, July, that's about 50 years. I said, well, it's not April, September. I don't want it in here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, these are months from the first test. Months from the first test. 36.
Okay.
This will go to 36 and 64.
Okay.
And these are the reasons for cut off. And where it was saying they were tested.
I see, yes.
Human error, facility error. These are the non-engine system errors that you...
And I believe there were 3 stands at Edwards that were designed to test the F-1, right? You've got 3 listed there. I believe there are 3 stands, or were there 4?
Well, there were 3 development stands and 2 production stands.
Oh, okay.
I think there were 5. I didn't remember more than
yeah.
That. I think there were 5.
Okay.
I think because if you look at those production rates, but you see here, here is GSE, here's an engine malfunction, GSE malfunction, mm-hmm. and so on. And you can run that up. That's a single test stand with 2, in other words, it has 1 set of tanks for 2 test positions.
Yes. Were all the stands dual position for the F1?
That I don't remember. Okay. I just don't remember.
I just know some, and I just became aware of this recently. I thought each test stand just had 1 position for an engine.
No.
Some had...
I know 1B1 and 1B2 were the same test stand, same set of tanks.
Yes.
You could be, of course, they had to go off to the other side when they actually ran the test, I think, but you could be working on 2 engines at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is the test, 2-7, so if you, in the first month we had 2 tests and they both ran, they're probably short duration, and then we had 7 tests, and we got 2 engine malfunctions and 1 facility malfunction. And then we got 6 tests and got 1 facility malfunction. I think these engine malfunctions here, I'll have to do my numbers to see if this adds up down here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah, a little of this is coming back now. Some of this is coming back now. This is, I didn't catch what I was looking at to start with. I thought this was a summary line to begin with because of the way this was, but you picked it up right and I didn't. This is 1A, 1B1, and 1B2.
Okay.
That's 3 test stands there. And
mm-hmm.
I think that may have been the development stand.
Development stands, yeah. I know there was a D, 1D, so I would assume there was a C in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe C and D were production stands then.
That could be. Whether they ever finished, you know, maybe they didn't finish one out too. I don't know, Philip, because we began to get better at testing. Facilities are 4-year or 5-year lead time, 4-year lead time, so
mm-hmm.
you have to.
Now, you know what's interesting? Edwards recently, just a couple of years ago, restored at least 1 of the stands.
Yeah,
and big deal on getting that restored because it has the capability of handling just about any size engine.
Yeah, and they cut the others up and sold them for scrap.
I know they tore down everything at Santa Susana, the old 1A test stand or Bravo test stand. They tore all that down.
This was 3 Edwards positions here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we had component testing. Another part of the thing was that at Santa Susana they had a significant component test. That's where they run pumps, whether it's just
right.
and valves and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, here's some plots made, and what this particular one is the team failure mode internal to the engine. This is engine failure.
And that stands for what? Do you understand?
Cumulative failure mode from premature cutoff. And this is from months of the start of the engine.
Uh-huh.
And some of these would be failure mode, this is all in other testing. This is the rate, and this is
cumulative engine test.
Engine test. Now that's just engine test, but you can see how this had a, and that's where we redesigned the engine and brought in the block two, based on what we learned this far.
Uh-huh.
And then it went off up here. And then we made some other changes. And see the rate picked up again, and it went out here, flattened off.
Yes.
Yep, I jumped Tracy there. Yeah, flattened off. And we were trying to get flat out here. Here's the J2 curve.
Uh-huh.
Finally got it flat. So what we were trying to do, reading from the testing rates, but notice out here how far it went before it went flat.
Mm-hmm. It took a while.
And they talked about 1,800 tests, but there were more than, some of the data talked about 1,800 tests, but at the time we flew the moon rocket, there was over 2,500 tests on the other one engine, 6 months before we flew.
Okay.
When we got
of varying tests, durations, but.
Well.
These were not just, in addition, including component tests, it was actual full engine of varying duration.
Yeah. Now, we've got a thing in here called equivalent pull duration in here, too. The time from the first engine test in months, you won't see how long it took to get somewhere, but
mm-hmm.
That should be the same as on that other curve. But before we got through with the, here was qual one, and we weren't satisfied with it because you can see the slope of the curve there.
Yeah.
Here's qual two out here, it's flat.
Mm-hmm.
Same way it went through back here on the J2, qual one, but it still had too much slope. So we went through and did some more testing and got the bogey worked out. It didn't get it quite flat.
Were these things you kept updated with each test, or was this established based on data over a period of time that allowed you to do the chart?
We did the chart retrospectively.
Yes.
The engineers, particularly, we had three reliability engineers assigned to the program office.
Mm-hmm.
And they monitor all this and kept it going and kept track of this and went through the data to see what the failure modes were, and they fed that back to the system. They were a support.
Okay.
It was Woody Bombera, Hal Steinberg, and Sid Lishman. And they did all the engines.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked at this and tracked it on a regular basis. That was their job, to keep track of things like this.
Okay.
Well, as the amount of, you know, some rework, anything that could affect reliability. And so this is the results of the records they kept over the years.
Okay. Yes, I understand. Okay.
It's not the actual record, which is all sorts of different looks at it here. But one of them I was looking for is called equivalent pull duration, which means we ran some 20-second tests, some 40-second tests, some 70-second tests, and what it did is it normalized it and said if these had been full duration tests, how would they, you know, how many of those would we have had if they come in flight? But anyway, but back to the point I made early on, you can see what we were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
We were interested in getting these failure curves to go flat.
Yes.
And as long as we were in here, we knew we couldn't make it. And we weren't putting these up on the wall, but we knew that we had to get them. And an interesting thing, let's see, somewhere in here is component test. There's some equivalent pull duration. But anyway, that's probably more than you want to say.
Hmm. No, I mean, it's
see,
an asterisk.
Here's an interesting one. Here is,
yeah.
This is for the J2 engine. It should be one for the F1 in here somewhere.